Hello, and welcome back to the Podcast of Things after a long break. I'm your host, as usual, Jake Lohr, and today I'm here with Zobron Elias. Elias, how do you pronounce it?
Elias.
Elias. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, good, good. Zobron is a fellow Trinity student and also a fellow college soccer player. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a neuroscience major here at Trinity, currently a sophomore, and I'm from Malawi. Small country in Southeast Africa. And I've been at Trinity for 2 years, but been in the U.S. for, I think, 6 years now. So starting to learn a little bit about New England culture, U.S. culture, but
very distinct. Still
very much Malawian.
Yeah, very distinct. And accordingly, the topic today will be about African philosophy, particularly African political philosophy, and the distinction between individualism, communalism, African. And also African exceptionalism versus universalism in the context of philosophy, and particularly political philosophy. But we'll get into that a little bit later. So Malawi, that's a long way away. What brings you to Trinity from Malawi, Zobron?
First of all, the college education is something that's really sought after and very valuable in Malawi. Education is not fully where it should be in a lot of developing nations, and Malawi being one of them, access to education as well. So ever since I was young, my family has really tried hard to make sure that I get well educated. So obviously getting the opportunity to be at a good college like Trinity College, and education before anything, was just a no-brainer for me and my family. And then obviously, like you said, I'm a college soccer player, so that was another big part of it, being able to play the sport that I grew up loving and still love so much. Was it had to be a part of the package for me. So
yeah. And was it a part of the package when you originally came over? Because you went to Taft. I don't actually know where that is, but Canada?
Yeah. No, Taft's like an hour away. So it's in Connecticut.
I associate Taft with Canada because we have another teammate who's Canadian and went to Taft.
It's always been a part of the package. The reason I came to the U.S. was through a soccer academy that I played for in Malawi, Ascend Soccer Academy. And one thing led to another, and somehow I got a scholarship to a really good boarding school in New England, which is called Taft, like Jake just said. And so, yeah, it was just a good opportunity to play really good level soccer, and as well as going to one of the best boarding schools in the area.
Yeah, you love to see it. Yeah. So what brings you to neuroscience now that you're at Trinity?
Neuroscience has been something that I've known for a while, even before Trinity. And I think it's just the brain, which sounds like a very obvious answer.
It's the brain.
There's really almost nothing we know about the brain for how important it is. And that just screams opportunity for me in terms of, like, the opportunity to discover so much more, the opportunity to build on what people have already discovered. And I also do find that the psychology side of it, like the neuropsychology side, looking at why people behave the way they do, whether that's social neuroscience or even like the cognitive neuroscience, why people think the way they think, those type of things. So I think that topic has really interested me. And obviously there's a lot more that goes into neuroscience, which I'm coming to discover along the way. There's, who would have thought chemistry was a part of it as well?
I probably could have told you that.
But there's a lot that goes into it, but it's more just the interest of the brain and why people do the things they do and why they behave the way they behave. And
lots of overlap with philosophy. Are we just the brain? That's a whole question in itself. We won't get into it. But that was a great introduction to neuroscience. I think you may have beaten out my last neuroscience guest.
Oh, really?
Rashid. Yeah, I think your introduction to neuroscience was better.
Take that, Rashid.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get into a little bit of what we're going to talk about in the context of African philosophy. So first of all, you were supposed to take this class with me that I'm taking on Africana philosophy. Very disappointed you didn't, but it's okay because you'll get to participate in the discussion today.
Exactly.
But in essence, the main framing question that we're going to want to look at today, I think, is this idea, this widespread idea in both within African philosophy in terms of African philosophers and what people think about African philosophy from the outside looking in, is that African philosophy is very distinct from Western or European philosophy in that African philosophy is centered on communitarianism or communalism or family, whereas Western philosophy is centered on individualism and me, myself, and I and more capitalist structures versus socialism, for example, or certain types of socialism. And so we're going to kind of ground our discussion in Julius Nyerere's piece about Ujamaa, which he considers the basis of African socialism. So Julius Nyerere was a Tanzanian anti-colonial activist, politician, and political theorist or political philosopher. He governed what was called – I might pronounce this incorrectly. I might pronounce a lot of things incorrectly today. He governed Tanganyika. Is that how you pronounce it?
Tanganyika.
Okay, there it is.
More or less, yeah.
More or less. Yeah. As prime minister for a while, and then he was the president, and then he was also president of Tanzania, its successor state. So we're going to get into a little bit of reconstruction on what his short piece says. I'd love to just get your initial thoughts on this dichotomy. Like, do you think it's accurate? Is this something that you've seen, especially as someone that's lived in both places? Because, of course, it's a philosophical argument, but it's also a cultural argument in the sense that there's this idea that the cultures are very different in these two ways. And I think, as we'll discuss later, Nyerere was definitely someone who thought that.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who has lived in both of these environments for a big part of my life, I will say there are, like, stark differences in terms of the culture. Mm. In relation to how it is to live as an individual versus how it is to live as a part of a community. And in, I think in Africa, less so these days, you're part of the community first before your individual goals and whatnot. I mean, even if you talk about your goals or you ask a kid, what do you want to be? What do you want to do when you grow up? It's in the context of, I want to do this so that I can help my community in this way, or I think I can be more useful to the most useful to my community by doing this. Whereas in the United States, it sort of seems more like, you know, it's the land of opportunity where everyone can be whatever they want to be, and it's not, there's not really anything attached to that in terms of community. It's not really,
yeah,
if you want to be a doctor but your community needs you as an engineer, reconsider. It's sort of like, if I want to be a doctor, I'm going to be a doctor. And there's structures that I can follow to chase that, which obviously I'm exaggerating both. But I will say, as someone who has lived in both places, that is definitely true to an extent, where community is valued a lot more in Africa, in Malawi, I should say, than in the U.S. communities that I've lived in.
That's interesting. And so how do you think that's affected you and your desire, before we get into the specific philosophers, how do you think that's affected you and your desire to pursue neuroscience in America, those sorts of – do you plan on moving back to Malawi, and is that related to community at all? Yeah, just your general thoughts.
Well, to me, I think one of the biggest parts of community for me is sort of keeping me grounded, the idea that I'm part of something bigger than myself, which does help a lot. I mean, it's obviously I'm in college and I'm 20 years old and you want to have fun and, you know, there's a lot of distractions and whatnot. But at the same time, in the back of my mind, more in the front of my mind, actually, is like this idea that everything I do sort of impacts my community, and the idea that there's potentially people looking up to me, because there's a million people in Malawi who would kill for an opportunity to go to a U.S. college. So it's sort of like everything you do represents your community in that way. So
interesting.
That's a huge part of my experience. But at the same time, coming to the U.S. where everyone's sort of every man for himself or herself, every woman for herself, has opened my eyes to sort of a different way of viewing things, where, yes, I am a part of my community, but there is opportunity to express myself as an individual. There's an opportunity for me to be who I truly want to be.
Right.
Aside from what I was sort of preordained to be and whatnot.
Right, yeah. No, that's really interesting that you tie it to community in that way. So one of the philosophers that I wanted to bring up today is named, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong again, but Mogobe Bernard Ramos, I think, who's a South African philosopher. And he basically has this concept of Ubuntu, which is this idea. I don't know if, like, if you've ever – South Africa is not anywhere near Malawi, but I don't know if you've ever heard of, like, similar phrases, but it's this idea of beingness and, like, he says that Ubuntu is always towards something, basically, and it's therefore always a ness and not an ism. And which is like a very dense way of saying that he thinks the ethics of African philosophy are expanding and ever changing and distinct from ideology in the sense like an ism, like capitalism, communism, things like that, or even you might say feminism, are like these distinct rigid ideologies, where he's saying the ethics of Africa are sort of ever moving and ever encompassing and are all about change and fluidity, which is still kind of opaque in what he's talking about. And in some ways, his article, that at least the one that I've read, is like that in general. But a very prevalent theme that we talked about in a course I took on Africana philosophy that I'm still taking is this idea of I am because we are. So I'd be curious to know if you've ever had any experience with like that phrase or that idea, which basically means like to be a person and to be a human in a political community or just a society depends upon other people, which, like you've talked about, is really distinct from what we think about in American or Western traditions, where you have both culture and philosophy that's more grounded in people like John Locke, where it's like everyone is an individual and I will pursue my interests and other people exist only insofar as they help me to pursue my interests, but we are all, you know, sort of atomized people, versus this idea that's attributed to Africana philosophy or African philosophy that like to be a human is really to be part of other people and it's to be a we rather than I. So like, are there any phrases like that that you've encountered growing up in Africa, or just a general sense? I know you've already said you kind of do get that general sense, but.
I mean, I think the way I was brought up and the way a lot of people are brought up, coming from a structure point of view, sort of sets us up to think in that way, in the more communal way.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the U.S., in the Western world, it's more common to have, you know, just mom and dad, siblings in a house.
Mm.
In Africa and in Malawi, it's more mom and dad and siblings. And that might be just your house, but, you know, not too far, a mile or so down the street, will be your grandma and grandpa, and then your mom's sisters and brothers and your dad's brothers and sisters and whatnot. And growing up, you know, I used to look forward to the family, you know, the family trips to grandma's house, and instead of like how it is in the U.S. where it's like, oh, we're gonna go visit grandma for, you know, a day, spend the day, a couple hours over.
Right.
Like, my parents take me and my siblings to my grandma's house and we spend a month, 2 months of the summer there. And sometimes it would even be like just me and my sister with my grandparents and cousins and everything, and all the parents are gone. And it's just, you know, that bond between grandparents and grandchildren, passing on family traditions. And that's like, that's a really important part of African culture, passing down traditions, passing down values, which I feel like gets lost a little bit in the U.S. because it's so, it's less extended family.
Right.
From a structural point of view. So I think I was just set up, and a lot of people growing up in Malawi were sort of just set up to think in a more communal point of view. And then also what that allows as well, when you spend so much time with your grandparents, your aunts and uncles and whatnot, it allows you to see everything that goes into running your family.
Interesting.
For example, when my dad's mom passed away, my grandma, a couple years ago, her house was sort of like the gathering point for my dad's side of the family, hosting all the family reunions and whatnot. And it wasn't always like only family reunions. My family happened to live, I think, the furthest away out of all her children, which was only like an hour away. Everyone else actually lived at her house. Like the rest of my cousins grew up in her house. But once she passed away, it was so evident her presence was just gone.
Yeah.
Like the sense of community sort of left, and it was and still is really hard to rebuild that community because of all the work put in by those, I guess, elders, for lack of a better word, all the work put in by these elders to conjure up the culture, you know, to keep the traditions going, to keep the sense of family, the sense of community going.
Right.
And that's such an important part, which I think is being lost a little bit in the modern world as people are trying to adapt to a more Western way of living, a more capitalist way of living.
Yeah, that's interesting. So that's fascinating. That actually resonates a lot with this sort of idea of the extended family, but also the tension between like modern free enterprise capitalism versus sort of traditional African values is another thing that philosopher Ramos talks about. He talks a little bit about Ubuntu being a fluid category means that family is more fluid. So instead of mom, dad, child, like you said, it's a more expansive definition of family, which is like cousins, grandparents, and sometimes even people who aren't your direct family mm-hmm. or your blood family. Mm-hmm. He says that in the context of modern capitalism in Africa, where people, you know, need to be employed, like lots of people do labor, for example, but not everyone is employed. So to be employed in order to, you know, sustain yourself and your family gives rise, in his opinion, to a sort of culture of nepotism in Africa, in which, because Ubuntu as a philosophy, at least in South Africa, sort of demands that you are caring for this fluid extended family, it seems right and ethical, and is right and ethical under that precept, under that philosophy, to sort of take care of your brothers and your cousins who come to ask for jobs and things like that. And so I wonder if just you've had any experience with that, and also like how you contrast that in Africa to in America, because in America there's also nepotism, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. he talks about it as if it's almost a uniquely African thing, but clearly there's also a lot of nepotism that goes on in America. So I wonder if maybe the nepotism isn't as essentially African as Ramos makes it seem.
I don't think it is solely an African thing, but I do think in Africa it's seen a lot in the political sense, and mm-hmm. I'm not one who's too politically inclined, to be honest, but yeah. I think it is very obvious where a president will be elected and it will be just a complete change of the entire cabinet and ministers, and everything is completely different. And all the people that are elected will be people, obviously it's, I guess, common for a president to hand select the people, right. But there are many, I guess, questionable people elected who's like, oh, what's the president's brother doing as the minister of health?
Yeah.
Why is the minister of education the president's That's brother-in-law, you know? And I think why Ramos emphasizes that is because it's so obvious.
Right.
Whereas, I mean, in America, it is obvious in the sense that, you know, someone gets hired to a big company and just happens to be the son of the CEO or something
right,
like that.
Right.
I mean, it is obvious in that sense, but when you're talking about politics and you know, the government, people that are running the entire country, and there's no sort of regulation of that, it's so obvious, sort of, I guess, without shame,
right.
Then it does become a problem, yeah. And I will say that has been a problem in terms of corruption in African politics over the past whatever many years,
yeah.
Not to get too political again.
Right.
But it is definitely an obvious problem.
Well, you're allowed to be political, first of all. But second of all, also, I wonder if part of that is also because economics in Africa, because it's a different context than the U.S., are more tied to politics than they are to business. So like opportunity in Malawi might look more like having a department of this or that job, whereas in the U.S. it looks like Goldman Sachs, and it's more hidden because not people aren't looking at who's employed at Goldman Sachs and whether or not there's nepotism. But I wonder, though, like your observation is definitely consistent with what Ramos seems to observe writing a while ago. But Ramos indicates that he thinks this is because of like the philosophy of South African people. Do you think that that's the case, or do you think there's a different explanation for it?
I mean, I think it is a huge part of it.
Right.
There are other things that go into it. I mean, obviously, if you were to get elected as president and say, you know what, I want to do this completely my way, my minister of education is going to be someone that is fully qualified in this mm-hmm. sector. And it doesn't matter who you are, I'm not accepting you, whether you're my brother and whatnot. That would be different. But I think because it's almost seen as like, you know, it's atrocious for you to tell your brother who has a decent college education and has
right.
a decent resume that no, I'm president, but you cannot be in my staff.
Yeah.
You can't be my minister or whatever.
That's exactly what Rameau says. Interesting.
It's almost it would be like a taboo. It's like
right.
Who brought you up? Where were you raised? Like, who do you think you are?
And then that's fascinating.
It would be all of a sudden. I mean, the country might appreciate it, but even though the country will appreciate it, your grandma's going to be like, "Wow, like where did you grow up? Did you not
right.
grow up under my roof for however many years?"
That's
so disappointed. So there's sort of that. You can't really let your family down, your community down in that sense.
Yeah, because community is so much more prevalent.
Yeah.
I wonder, though, so how can we disaggregate? Because Ramos, of course, is a philosopher, so he's a little biased. He's, like, not an anthropologist. But he sees it as generally not just a cultural thing, he says explicitly, but a philosophical thing. How do we disaggregate culture from philosophy, or do we even need to? Like, so clearly it's a cultural thing that mm-hmm. places such an emphasis on family. Are there any ways in which you think that it's also like a philosophical thing? Like this is just the ethics. Like if you ask someone to tell you what their ethics are in Malawi or in Africa, they would have a very different ethical compass sort of. Like not moral compass because ethics and morals are different, but a different ethical compass. Or do you think that it's kind of just a conflation between philosophy and culture that can't really be separated?
Well, I mean, I think it is almost impossible to sort of talk about culture without talking about culture.
Yeah.
Because culture provides context, I think, for the philosophy. I could say that I subscribe to Hobbesian philosophy, but because I grew up in Malawi, I might add a Malawian twist to it, you know what I mean?
Right.
It would be in the context of my environment, and that's where the culture comes in. So I do think that because of the culture, the philosophy is very different. And I think that ethically, that is such an important part of our ethics. If you ask a Malawian, what do you value? I guess some of the big things they'll say is religion, probably, whatever religion that is. Like Christianity and Islam are the two biggest. There's not really atheism. If I were to walk around the streets of Malawi and if someone were to say, oh, they're an atheist, it would be like, oh, my goodness, like, what's going on, you know? It's crazy. And in the same way, if someone were to say, well, I believe in individualism, I believe that every man for themselves, everyone would laugh and be like, wow, okay, so you're just a selfish person, you don't care for your community,
right?
You clearly didn't grow up in Malawi, you know? So it's sort of a vital part of our ethics system, a vital part, not necessarily moral compass, because as you said, ethics and morals are a bit different, but it is a vital part of our values and even belief system that family, community, and that type of tie needs to be an important part of anyone's mentality and even an important part of the way you live your life.
Right. Yeah. It's really interesting. And like we talk about the family and just a general sense of community. And I think that factors so much into even people like Nyerere. How do you pronounce it again?
Nyerere. Yeah.
People like Nyerere who then are presidents and rulers of countries and things like that. So let's connect the family to his idea of Ujamaa or African socialism really briefly. I'll be quick, make sure I'm not monologuing. Interrupt me if I am. But in essence, Nyerere wants to say that African socialism is basically an extension of the family into society. So the society is like one big family, one big community in which everyone works for one another. And he's really big on the idea of, at least in this article he writes about Ujamaa, about considering socialism as a frame of mind, like capitalism would be a frame of mind. So he says, in the individual, as in the society, it is an attitude of mind which distinguishes the socialist from the non-socialist. It has nothing to do with the possession or non-possession of wealth. Destitute people can be capitalists, exploiters of their fellow human beings. A millionaire can equally well be a socialist. He may well value his wealth only because it can be used in the service of his fellow men. But the man who uses wealth for the purposes of dominating any of his fellows is a capitalist. So is the man who would if he could. So in essence, he's saying that he ultimately says that a millionaire is unlikely to be the product of a socialist society because a millionaire, you know, is not he says there are millionaires in poor countries and rich countries, mm-hmm. and the reason for millionaires is the distribution of wealth, the uneven distribution of wealth, rather than the particular mode of production or anything like that. But he's really interested in the mindset of socialism, and it's really African socialism for him is, like I say, an extension of the family. And so he ultimately goes on to, of course, have his basic critique of capitalism, in which he thinks that people are making a lot more money than they are working for, in essence, and they're sort of exploiting their fellow people. Mm-hmm. They're not contributing to the community in the same way as others who are laboring, and these are landlords, employers, and these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And because of this, he's really attentive to this group of people he calls like the idlers, the loiterers, and basically the parasites. And so he says that these are people who are capitalists, like they just live off other people who do their labor for them. Mm-hmm. But these are also people who don't want to work. And he in essence says that the people who don't want to work in Africa were – he was writing this in the time of like the 1960s or 1990s maybe. But he was basically saying that in traditional African society, the idea that someone wouldn't want to work or contribute to the society is unthinkable. Like no one would ever be like that. And that socialism is basically a traditional African value, that there is ingrained in African society a sort of socialism that – accounts for people wanting to all contribute to the community equally. And so because of this, he talks about this saying that is a Swahili saying that I'm not going to try to say in Swahili because I'm going to say it wrong.
Fair enough, I don't like Swahili either.
But it translates into treat your guest as a guest for 2 days. On the third day, give him a hoe. And then Nyerere says, in actual fact, the guest was likely to ask for the hoe even before his host had to give him one. Mm-hmm. So he's basically saying that everyone wants to work for each other. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to hear about if that's been your experience and what are the ways in which you think that that maybe has changed from traditional African society, if you think it was like that in traditional African society, to now in a more modern African context.
I mean, first of all, I love that quote at the end. I think it's very, very important, and a very important part of the African mentality.
Mm-hmm.
I remember coming to the U.S. My mom couldn't emphasize enough the importance of, because obviously I live with a host family over long breaks, couldn't emphasize the importance of, you know, chores and things like that. And I've always been pretty decent about doing chores growing up, mm-hmm. washing dishes, making my bed and things like that. But she couldn't emphasize the importance of, you know, every single morning when you wake up, make sure you make your bed and make sure you ask them, how can I help with dinner? You know, what do I need to do to clean up in this room? Or what can I do to, you know, help out with this chore? Or can I do this? Can I do that? Which I think might catch some Americans by surprise a little bit. And I mean, it is sort of normal. You're living in someone else's house. It is sort of normal to try to go the extra mile. But I think in African societies, it's more exaggerated. It's even more visible because you want to show that you're part. You're doing mm-hmm. your best to be a part of that community. You're appreciative of what they're doing. And something that is not huge in Africa is like the actual literal expression of gratitude, like saying thank you, which culturally was a little bit of a change for me. Like literally saying thank you for everything, because how Africans will show that they're thankful is by the actions to the community.
Oh, that's interesting. So you don't say thank you actually,
yeah,
as often?
Which I do like the U.S. version where you say thank you a lot, but I think both need to be implemented. I think there's a healthy medium of both, where you say thank you and your actions follow that you're actually thankful.
That's interesting.
I think that's a part of it.
Yeah.
And then the second half of what you said, just addressing the more modern mentality. I think looking at the structure of Malawi, I can't speak for all of Africa, but
I do
know a bit about Malawi. I think if you look at the more elitist part of Malawi, you know, the top 1%, whatever you want to call it, they definitely adopt a more capitalist version of living in terms of mentality.
Mm-hmm.
It does, at least from the outside looking in, it does seem like every man for themselves. It does seem like everyone is doing whatever it takes for them to get rich, and them to get more publicity or even in the context of a president, them to get reelected versus the more communal way of leading the country, which was more of a thing back in the 90s. We gained our independence in 1964, and I think our first president is one of the most, probably the most loved president in our histories because of all he did for the country, aside from fighting for independence, but also just the work he did for community building. And that looked like building schools, like half of the really good schools in Malawi were built by him. All the roads, like, you know, all the main roads besides a couple more modern ones these days were all built by him. Even like housing, you know, you pass by an area and it'll all just be rows and rows of houses built by him. So it's sort of like he truly embodied that sense of, I will do whatever it takes to make my country sort of up to par with where it needs to be.
Right.
And fix all the damage that we've suffered. And then in more modern history, the issue is that people went from, like, my parents grew up, you know, seeing that and seeing a leader who, obviously, not to say he was perfect, many flaws, many issues and whatnot, but seeing that side of a leader who was willing to do whatever it takes to lead his country to a better place. And it sort of seemed like, okay, so the next leader is supposed to continue this job and we're all, you know, on a good path. And then all of a sudden, the next few leaders, in terms of government and politics and whatnot, sort of seem to be more, I'm just trying to get rich, you know, I'm just doing whatever it takes for me and my brother and sister and, you know, whoever I decide to bring up with me to be able to get richer.
And what do you think accounts for that change, especially since we've kind of said that the philosophy and culture of African society tends to be more communitarian and more family-oriented?
I think the more Western ideologies, because, I mean, if you look at where a lot of these presidents were, and I'm not necessarily saying this is an issue with the presidents. I'm talking more of, like, it's a general issue in Malawi now. But I'm using the presidents because they're the most visible, typically.
Yeah.
A lot of high-end people are educated in Western countries. If you look at their degrees, they all come to college in the U.S. and whatnot. So there is sort of an adoption of the more Western culture.
That's interesting.
And I think the more we as Malawians or maybe even Africans have seen that, okay, so in this country, this is how people are doing. I mean, there's an opportunity for a more individualist mentality, and it seems like, hey, maybe I'll get there faster if I go on my own and think more about myself. Then that's what I need to bring to my country. I think that's sort of what has been going on the past couple of years, which, for better or for worse, I guess. But I think it is definitely a problem in the sense that the people are not happy, because it's like, why are we straying from, you know, working as a community?
That's interesting.
We always have.
And do you think the majority of people are, like, upset with this sort of new influx of ideology? Of course, you don't know, like, you haven't taken a poll, but, like, just your sense is, like, does this communitarian ideology still stand firm even with an influx of sort of Western individual ideology?
Yeah, but now it's sort of, I think the disparities or the tensions between upper class and lower class, or whether I think it would probably be grouped as, like, middle and lower class versus upper class, I don't know if the tensions have ever been higher in our history. I think it's sort of like, well, it's now us middle and lower class people. Let's stick together. We can still, you know, still keep at these community values. But those guys over there, the rich people, don't care about us anymore. So it's just us versus them. We're going to survive. And that's been coupled with, obviously, economic difficulties, including post-pandemic and inflation and whatnot. And it's I think a lot of people sort of feel like, oh, now we don't really have any help. Before it was like, okay, Malawi is a developing nation, but we have, you know, a way out. We have help. We have leaders or more wealthy people who care for us and are trying to do something for our country. Now it's sort of like, well, guys, we just have to figure it out for ourselves. It's just
us
against them.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. So do you think that this is – we're getting kind of off on a tangent, so I'll rope it back in a second. But do you think that there's less, like, valorization of the millionaire class, for example? Because in America, everyone is like, oh, I want to be Bill Gates. Like, I want to be Mark Cuban. You know, like, it's – oh, he's such a genius. He made it. Do you think there's more distaste than valorization for this sort of 1% in Malawi, or do you think it's similar?
I think it's more, it's never, I want to be X rich person in Malawi. It's, I want to be Bill Gates. It's Malawian people like, oh, I want to be that person from this country. It's not really us trying to be like the rich people of our country.
Or oh, that's interesting.
Or the professional athletes of our country or whatever. It's like, oh, I want to be Bill Gates when
like
I grow
literally
up.
Literally Bill Gates.
Literally Bill Gates versus a Malawian version of that.
Right, that's interesting.
Because there's such a distaste towards the rich Malawians, right. Successful Malawians, however you quantify success.
Yeah. But, there's this famous quote about America, and I think it's attributed to someone who didn't actually say it, but some author, but it's like, the reason why socialism has never taken hold in the United States is because the poor in America do not see themselves as the exploited working class, but instead see themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. And I think that's a really interesting quote.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if like there's any ways in which you think that's different in Malawi. Like, of course, that's a huge generalization for the United States.
Mm.
But if there's any ways in which you think that's different in Malawi, or if you think it's becoming more like that, or just your general thoughts on, you know, the difference.
I think it is becoming more like that.
Mm.
It obviously it's hard to generalize,
right? Of course,
and I think it's flipped from the American version of that. I think it's sort of like if you ask someone that's not doing well financially, like, oh, how do you feel about life? They'll be like, oh, we're poor, like we're struggling, like we're hopeless. What are we gonna do? And that's I think a mentality that's more prevalent now than when I grew up. When I grew up, it sort of felt like Malawi's roaring 20s in terms of
interesting.
And obviously, I mean, I was a child, so it was hard for me to
get that.
But just basing off of you know. My parents, adults I've interacted with, people I've talked to, and even my experience myself as a child, it sort of seemed like, you know, everything was all good. Life was all rosy, even though, I mean, there's still a million problems and whatnot going on at the time. But everyone still has sort of hope. And I will say they probably thought, oh, we're just, you know, millionaires waiting to blossom.
Right, right.
And then now, 10 years down the line, 2024, oh, I'm still not rich. These people just don't care about me. I mean, my business is still not supported by the government. Oh, I'm still not, you know, inflation is still an issue in this country. And I was sort of like, well, I guess it's just us against them and we're just, you know, oppressed poor people.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And I mean, I think I can kind of predict your answer to this. But one of the things Nyerere says is that he says, when a society is organized that it – when a society is so organized that it cares about its individuals, then provided he is willing to work or they are willing to work, no individual within that society should worry about what will happen to him tomorrow if he does not hoard wealth today. Society itself should look after him or his widow or his orphans. This is exactly what traditional African society succeeded in doing. Both the rich and the poor individual Both the rich and the poor individual were completely secure in African society. Natural catastrophe brought famine, and it brought famine to everybody, poor or rich. So he's basically saying like when people starved, and everybody was willing to help each other. So nobody he says somewhat famously that nobody starved because of they had a lack of personal wealth, basically. Mm-hmm. So like it seems like you're saying that maybe that used to be the case, those communal values that sort of uplifted everyone in society and that they've sort of eroded over time. But I wonder if you still think there's an element of that in Malawi or if you think there's not or if you agree, do you think this is a fair characterization of traditional African society? Of course, you weren't there maybe for traditional African society, but you, of course, have inherited a rich tapestry of history that you've been told about what traditional African society has looked like. Mm.
I do think it's still there, but again, I think it's not really all the country together. It's sort of now lower and middle class help each other out. Like, and I mean, it's not all perfect, obviously, but I think it's sort of the lower and middle class stick together. I can rely on my neighbor, sort of that kind of feeling, whereas before it used to be I can rely on my countrymen, you know, lower class, middle class, upper class, whatever it is, because we're all unified as a country working towards a common goal. Now it's like we're not really working towards a common goal because lower and middle class are now – a lot of them, their goal is now just like, okay, just survive. And then upper class is like, oh, get richer. So there's that you know, huge disparity and that gap that's
right
seems to be growing. So, I think it is different
growing
now,
places.
But it is very similar in the sense that we are a strong community. It's just what community is has been redefined and reshaped a little bit.
Like, and so just to clarify, what community is has been reshaped from what to what in general? From, like, the whole nation being a community to now there being different sort of pockets of community or different class-based
Exactly. I think more it was like, oh, I'm a Malawian. So as a Malawian, you know, we're working towards a common goal, whatever that goal was or is. But now I think it's more, I'm a Malawian, yes, but I'm a Malawian who is a middle-class person, or I'm a Malawian who is a poor person. Therefore, I will seek help within my poor community.
Yeah,
you know, so it's more separated. It's more separate, I'd say, than it has been.
Right. So, let's transition a little bit to close with this sort of final debate that arises in the literature about African socialism, which is that Nyerere basically wants to say that African socialism is very unique, right? So it's not like capitalism where it's every man for themselves, every person for themselves, but in traditional capitalism, man. And it's also not like Marxism. He says it's very different than Western European Marxism, which is essentially like an eternal struggle, which he calls civil war, of class conflict between the capitalists and the proletariat. So he says that Marxism relies upon this tension, this class conflict. And he says that there isn't even a word for class conflict in most African societies. There's not even a word for class, he says. So to him, African socialism is very unique because it doesn't arise from capitalist exploitation. It is the traditional basis of African society in the sense that people just help each other. That's how things work. And so that's like a really interesting take on what it means to organize politically in Africa, because the implications are the most authentic thing to do would be this sort of socialism that's neither Marxism nor capitalism. But there's also Nigerian philosophers like a man named Taiwo Olufemi Taiwo, I think. I'm just butchering these names. I'm so sorry. But he argues that actually reproduces the colonial logic that says Africans are so different, because part of colonialism was to say that Africans are so different than other humans that they need to be treated as such. And so Taiwo is basically saying that Nyerere is affirming that by saying, oh, what is going on in Africa, or what traditional African society, is so different than Europe and it needs to be conducted along such lines. So his argument is that to reject individualism on that basis doesn't really make sense. So what are your thoughts on that? Can you have this idea of unique African socialism without sort of creating this idea that Africans are such different as human beings than Europeans?
That's difficult. I think culture is a huge part of it. Again, you're talking about more political ideas, but I think a lot of it stems from culture. Malawi is sort of nicknamed the warm heart of Africa. It's a country. I think David Livingston is the guy who gave it that little nickname.
Who is Dave Livingston?
You know, he was just a missionary back in the day who did his work in Malawi, majorly Malawi, and loved the country, I guess. I mean, it's a country where you're driving down the side of the road, and anywhere you are, you get lost, you stop and ask anyone for directions, and without even thinking about it, they'll, you know, point you in the right direction. And you don't really have to think about it. Like, no one will literally be like, oh, sorry, I'm busy, I don't have time. I think that's just a part of our culture. Is we're always trying to help each other. And again, I'm sort of painting it as a fairy tale land where, you know, it's not fully like that, but it's just such a huge part of our culture that it's impossible to ignore that politically. And I guess socialism is not necessarily a perfect system, neither is capitalism. I don't know if there is a perfect political system, but socialism does embody that culture of helping more. So I think it is sort of fair to say that we've built a socialist structure based off of our culture. But again, it is difficult to sort of say that without marginalizing ourselves. But I do think that we have to accept that there are differences. We do have. So I mean, if I were to take sides, I'd take, I think, Nyerere's side a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because I think that you do have to accept your differences, because culturally, there are certain conversations I can have in Malawi just because I grew up in Malawi that would not be socially acceptable in the U.S., for example, and vice versa. There are certain things in the U.S. I talk about or have heard people talk about, which you say that in Malawi, and it's like, oh, my goodness, like, how could you possibly say that? I gave an example of religion, for example, atheism, talking about the concept of believing there's or not believing in any god. If you say that in a lot of parts of Malawi, it's like there's no way that's possible.
Right.
And if you're looking at it from a Malawian from a Malawian point of view, if Malawi were the superpower of the world, the U.S. would be the different country. It would be the
right,
other,
right.
But because the U.S. and other such countries are on the other side of the spectrum, sort of the superpower of the world, they get the benefit of looking at us as the other. But to be fair, we are the other from their perspective.
Yeah.
And they are the other from our perspective. It's just that their perspective gets to be expressed more and is more public, because if I say something, if I'm famous in the U.S. and I say something, goes on the news, the whole world hears it. If I say, "Oh, I don't agree with African socialism," the whole world hears it, and it's more likely to be adopted, I think, because the U.S. is sort of a more quote-unquote powerful country.
Yeah.
If it were the other way around, it would be fully fair to say, oh, people in the U.S. are different from Malawi, because they are. So I think it's impossible to say, it's impossible to talk about Africa versus the U.S. or Africa versus England without saying different. The word different is impossible to me.
Yeah.
And I think it does have to be said. I think what needs to be done, if we're talking about overcoming that marginalization of colonialism, is to accept that Africa is different.
Oh, interesting.
The U.S. is different.
Yeah, that's very Nyerere. That's what he would say.
You know, Denmark is different from the U.S. There are probably more similarities between Denmark and the U.S. because of where they are in terms of development as a nation. But if you dive in culturally, Denmark is very different than the U.S., for example, two arbitrary countries.
Yeah.
So I think difference, it needs to be accepted that, you know, we're two completely different societies. There are similarities. But just inherently, the way I grew up is just different from the way most, if not everyone, in the U.S. grew up.
Right, yeah. And I think that's really interesting. I think Taiwo might find it complicated, because he would want to say, well, you know, yes, culture is different, but by reaffirming that this culture is so different, we further marginalize ourselves, like you already acknowledge is a question. And then I think another question arises, like, is this culture essentially different? Like, will Africans, for example, and people in Denmark always be different, or are there conditions that make them different? And I think taking that sense actually opens up the door to wonder, and I would argue that Nyerere actually has a very valid argument, in the sense that it might not necessarily be cultural essentialism, like, oh, African people are just a different people, like you can never compare them. But also you might wonder what sorts of social organizations arise from different sorts of realities and contexts. So, like, maybe socialism in Europe is very different than socialism in Africa, not because Africans are necessarily so different than Russians, for example, but because the conditions under which socialism emerged were very different. And I think in that sense, it's very I find Nyerere's argument compelling and would defend it on the basis that, yeah, it seems like he makes a compelling argument, and you seem to reaffirm that socialism is a sort of attitude and social structure based on family and community that arose in Africa without this concept of class struggle, whereas maybe that wasn't the case in Europe, or maybe it was the case in Europe, but our most recent experience with socialism manifests itself through things like the Russian Revolution or the Paris Commune, which are, you know, violent interactions.
Yeah. I think an example of that – I know we're running out of time, but
yeah.
I think an example of that is that you look at our first president of Malawi. His name was Kamuzu Banda, sort of seen as a national hero in a sense. He was a dictator.
Right.
He arose as a dictator.
This is the first person you said was, like, great and built all the schools. That's interesting. Okay.
Great president as far as, you know, history is concerned, as far as the image of him now is painted. And he did some wrong things societally, I guess, terrible things whatever you want to call it, he was a dictator, which traditionally dictatorship is seen as bad. You know, you think of dictator, you think of bad. Mao Zedong is like, you know, forcing power. But at the same time, you have this dictator who is arguably the most important part of our history and the reason why we are where we are now versus 10 steps back. Mm,
yeah.
So you have to think about the context in which, like, political organizations and government forms of government arose. So I think you ask a Malawian what they think about dictatorship, they'll say, oh, yeah, dictatorship isn't, you know, should be democracy. Like, we are now, it's better to share the power. But then you tell them, oh, your first president was a dictator. They'll say, well, it's different. You
know, that's interesting.
It's not fair to call him a dictator because XYZ. You know what I mean?
Are there words for like upper, middle, lower class or class conflict now in your language? Or is it something that you ever hear about?
Not really class. It's more to do with financial success, wealth. It's like, you know, rich. Like when you think of upper class, there's just sort of the general term rich.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like ole mira would be like the term, which means like rich, wealthy, but not really the class that we use to describe in English.
Right. Yeah. Because he's like Nyerere says, Africans have no conception of class. Enemies, indeed. Nyerere doubts if the equivalent for the word class exists in any African language. So, like, you seem to be agreeing with that even after the
introduction. I don't think there really is. I mean, to be fair, English is my first language, but
because you speak
really
English
think.
In Malawi in general?
Yeah.
Like your family speaks
English? Yeah, my
family
speaks
both.
Most people understand at least a little bit of English.
Right.
But I speak English in my house. I don't think there is a word for class that I can think of, at least off the top of my head.
That's really interesting. Yeah. And I think, you know, another thing about Nyerere that I would say to defend his point briefly, we do have to conclude, but that I would say to defend Nyerere – how do you say it again?
Nyerere.
Nyerere. I sometimes have it and I sometimes lose it. But another point I would say to defend Nyerere is that he's not actually saying in his piece about African socialism that like Africans can't be capitalists because they're just so different, which is sort of the critique that Taiwo levels at him. He's actually saying that Africans can be socialists or can be capitalists, and it's a problem because Africans do exploit themselves. And his argument more so is actually that capitalism is bad, and then we should therefore, as an African society, he's saying, return to our roots, which are more grounded in this concept of Ujamaa, which is family socialism. Mm. And like we discussed, it's different from European Marxism. And so I think in that way, it's a very fair political program and doesn't necessarily play into this ideology that like, oh, Africans are like aliens compared to white people and white people are aliens compared to Africans. Mm. I think that you can have both. But like, how would you describe Malawi right now? Is it capitalist? Is it socialist? And what would you see as the way forward, especially in light of this debate between Taiwo, someone who's more in favor of adopting individualism and capitalism as a step forward, that's his whole argument, versus Nyerere, who's really argues for going back to these, like really leaning into these traditional African conceptions of Ujamaa, socialism, family, community?
I think Nyerere had a really good point, or has some really good points, and I think he predicted well where we are right now. So I give him credit for that.
Mm.
I'll say I think Malawi is very much capitalist now.
Yeah.
We're at an interesting time because we had been doing well, sort of pre-pandemic. Well is relative, I guess, but you know, we're a developing nation, like I've been saying, but we had been doing well, sort of making progress, and then it's just sort of been regression, and a lot of that is because of the capitalism, because the capitalism is sort of becoming like a every man for himself Hunger Game type
of
thing,
right,
which is like it's starting to be seen in the worst sense, and all of a sudden there's like Cashgate and Watergate and Mazegate. It's like,
are these all things in Malawi? That's interesting.
Scandals for every sort of commodity you can think of. And I think that is a result of the adoption of this like hyper-capitalist mentality, like, you know, every man for himself.
Right.
Which I don't know if the solution to that is going back to our quote-unquote roots, socialist roots, but there definitely has to be a change because the – regression is evident. Right. Maybe not to those in power or sort of the elitist, but to a lot of pretty much everyone else in the country, the regression is definitely evident.
Right. So Nyerere would probably resonate with them.
Yeah,
it seems
definitely.
Like. So, all right, let's leave it on this final question, which is just to rope in one more engagement, which is with Nigerian philosopher Ipa Diola from Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And she wants to argue that one problem with this Ujamaa, with African socialism, is the issue of feminism, which is basically that because of colonialism oftentimes, but oftentimes also just traditionally African society, the family will be very patriarchal. So to extend the family or the community to be the governing structure of all of society would basically be to extend patriarchal domination, and that's an issue. I personally would push back and argue and say – not push back. I would emphasize her own acknowledgement that that is also the case in Western capitalism and individualism. Mm-hmm. So it's not like a problem here and not a problem there. But how big of a problem do you see that as being with this sort of returning to African socialism versus, do you think capitalism is a liberatory version of feminism, or do you think it would actually be more feminist in a sense to return to this sort of Ujamaa conception of sort of unique African socialism?
I don't think capitalism has been like wave your magic wand and solve all the problems of gender inequality.
Yeah.
So there are definitely, like you said, problems with capitalism in the context of feminism.
But it has done some things, sounds like you're saying.
But Malawi has had their first, for example, I can't remember when it was, 10 years ago probably now,
yeah,
our first female president.
Mm.
And she came into power in a sort of funny way. Not funny, but the president died and she was a vice president and she took the throne for 2-3 years as a female. Yeah. And I don't think socialism changes anything about that, realistically.
Interesting.
I think there is a lot we need to do as a country. I think we're far behind in terms of women's rights. We're very far behind. But I don't think socialism does anything to hurt that, because socialism is, if we're calling socialism sort of we're equating it to the cultural respect of, you know, community and stuff.
Right.
A huge part of community is mothers, women, sisters, grandmothers, whatever that looks like. So I think, I'm not saying it would help, but I doubt it would hurt that in any way.
Interesting. So you don't think like structuring society on the basis of family would sort of reproduce male domination? You think that in some ways, you're saying basically it's like neutral.
Yeah, I think it's neutral. I don't think it changes anything. I think if you want to address a problem, you have to look specifically at the problem. If we're talking about improving gender inequality, we have to specifically tackle gender inequality.
Regardless of
socialism. Yeah, exactly.
But it does seem like individualism and capitalism has done some things, considering that there's like the first woman.
I mean, it allows the idea that anyone can, not to sort of, you know, Zootopia type of idea, but anyone can be anything. And that includes, for example, our first female president,
right,
who took power a couple of years ago. So capitalism has definitely helped that charge a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't think socialism hurts it.
Interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. This has been an excellent discussion about African philosophy and African socialism in particular, grounded in both Nyerere and Malawi, more so than Nyerere's Tanzania. But Zobron, thanks for coming. It's been a great episode.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, and hope to continue the discussions in the future.
And we're late to our team lift, so.
Wonderful.